getting at that imperative of discipleship, we try to get at the paragraphical structure of 831 to 991, because I think that will help us in trying to interpret these materials. It would also help us to look at the broader context. We'll look at that particularly with regard to 930 to 1052. But actually, we also ought to look at other elements, and we will look at some other elements, but we can't do a thorough job. And of course, we ought to look at scriptural testimony as well to discover what the scriptures as a whole say about this matter of discipleship and the disciples' cross. We can't exhaust this area, obviously. Let's get started anyway and see what we can do. I indicated that though when we traced the movement of 834 to 91, we found there primarily the matter of causation and substantiation with regard to this threefold exhortation, two elements of which I have here, deny yourself, take up your cross, and then follow me. But when you re-examine it, you actually find here a contrast involved. And I think we find some equations involved as well, or comparison involved, as we indicated in terms of the equal signs we have to close the last hour, but also certain contrasts that I think will illuminate each other as to what's involved in discipleship. I want to focus with you on two expressions here, although you have to have in mind always in this that the call is for discipleship or Christ-likeness, to follow Christ. So we have to keep in mind always what the cross meant for Christ, if you are to understand what the disciple's cross involves, since the disciple is a learner of Christ or a follower of Christ. As far as Christ says, follow me, do what I have done. So that the underlying element in all of this then is Christ-likeness. That's the basic assumption, which lies behind this. And so we need to keep the cross of Christ in mind and talk about that as we get at the meaning of these exhortations, particularly these two, denying oneself and taking up one's cross. Let's look at the first of these two. A word deny is susceptible of various interpretations. We could go through a number of them. In fact, if you look at the dictionary, you'll find seven definitions of deny. Let me call attention just to two of them, which you find in the context and in scriptural testimony. You find, for example, in 14:30 following of Mark, the denial of Christ by Peter. Now, what Peter was actually denying was that he knew Christ and was a disciple of Christ. So in that use, Peter was saying, I am not a disciple. I do not know Christ. So to deny is to affirm that something is not true or does not exist. Now, some have carried over that same meaning into this expression, and they have ended up with some kind of self-negation. I no longer exist. I deny that the I is any longer a reality. And we call that selflessness. There's no more self. And I would argue that this understanding of denying oneself is not valid in light of, one, the context, two, scriptural testimony, and three, what I might call the psychological element, the psychological factor, these three determinants in getting at the meaning of self-denial. For one thing, in the context, there is a clear-cut appeal to the self and the self-concern. That's what verse 35 means. If verse 35 does not suggest that one ought to be concerned about saving one's suke, one's life, And by the way, I think that word psyche essentially involves one's self-life. If that is not an appeal to a concern for oneself, then it has no meaning. The whole thrust of that verse is to say, you ought to be concerned about saving your psyche, your life, your self-life. So to deny oneself does not mean that you either lose yourself in terms of in the sense that the I no longer exists, or that you lose all self-concern. And indeed, scriptural testimony we had at the time would bear that out too. The I continues to exist. The I is never lost. Always the relationship with Christ and with God is an I-thou relationship. And the I always continues to function and to be in that relationship. Psychologically, there is no such thing as selflessness. Again, we always continue to be. The I is not wiped out in any way. Nihilism is not psychologically feasible. In fact, if one moves toward a real nihilism psychologically, one moves toward some kind of psychotic condition. Now, there's a second meaning that I think is involved here, and that is the meaning when we say, I denied myself a bar of candy. Now, when we use the word in that way, what we're saying is that I refused to grant my desire for a bar of candy. And what that implies is that this self, this psyche, has certain desires. And these desires might be reduced to two main kinds of desires, and this is not exhaustive, but at least gives us some idea of what's involved here. One has to do with desires which are intrinsically right. For example, we have the desire for self-preservation, including the preservation of one's life, physical life. We have the desire for approval, which is part of a herd instinct. We have the desire for comfort, which includes the desire for food, for example, and all those other things which make life comfortable. We have the desire to avoid pain. All of these are legitimate desires in themselves. On the other hand, and here we move to biblical testimony overall for most of our information, we have desires which are intrinsically wrong. We have what the scriptures call passions, these distorted cravings. For example, the desire for sex is intrinsically right. When that desire is distorted and warped so that it seeks to fulfill itself outside the sphere of what is right, then it becomes a passion or a lust. So that we have, finally, reduce it to two kinds, and I would like to add a third kind, but let's talk about just these two kinds. I would say that with regard to denying oneself, this statement means that concerning these wrong desires, these wrong passions, we ought not to gratify them, we ought not to express them, we ought not to allow them to control our lives. And there's no question of what the disciples were expressing, certain passions, certain wrong desires in their attitudes toward Christ and in their perspective. Christ-likeness. Christ had no problem at this point, I think. There are some theologians who think that his incarnation really involved his sharing even in these wrong desires, or what we call original sin, in spite of the virgin birth, because after all, he had his mother's genes, if not his human father genes, and those genes, they would say, are the carriers of these passions, and they would add that he is part of social history, and is therefore influenced by that history, as all of us are. But I do not think this was the issue in Jesus' case, thinking now in terms of Christ-likeness. However, this was the issue here in Jesus' case, and that is that he had certain right desires, certain very legitimate desires that he wanted to express. What is being said here is that desires in both kinds, wrong desires inherently, but even right desires, ought not to be gratified if and when they conflict with God's will. Now, this is closely bound up with the matter of taking up one's cross, and in that connection, let me call your attention to the experience in Gethsemane. We have a very, very interesting statement on the part of Christ. 14:36, and Christ said to God, Daddy, Father, my dear Father, all things are possible to thee. Remove this cup from me. Now he had said in 8:31, this cup, which he identifies as his cross in chapter 10, is inevitable, is imperative, is a must. Now he says, remove it. He adds, yet not what I will, but what thou wilt. Now note the contrast there as between his will, which he's just expressed, made that this suffering be removed. Why? Because it ran counter to certain desires which he had, very legitimate desires. He didn't want to die. He didn't want to die excruciatingly. He didn't want to die as a criminal, etc. So his humanity, as it were, and I'm not now making a clear-cut distinction between this humanity and deity, but the human facet, particularly, of his personality, was saying no to the cross. And rightly so. He was saying to the Father, if what I will, what I want, what I desire, say will, want, desire, these are all bound up together, is not your will, then your will be done. So that to deny oneself then is to refuse to gratify one's desires, always the wrong desires, because they're inherently wrong, but even the right ones, when they conflict with the will of God. Now, what that will is, we'll get at later on. Let me just say that you'll note how that relates to what he has said here with regard to the contrast, the negative. For to gratify one's desires is really to save one's life. Because saving one's life really has to do with saying, I want to preserve and maintain my life for myself. I want to use my life to realize my own, to gratify my own desires. See, that's what saving life means, as over against losing life. For Christ's sake in the Gospels, which means that I am willing to give up my own self and my own desires for the sake of someone greater than I am and beyond me. So that is over against them a self-centeredness. It says, I want my desires fulfilled. No matter whether it conflicts with the will of God and no matter what implications are for anybody else. Arrogance is saying, I am willing to give up my desires, to lose myself. I'm psuche. Even my desire for physical life, my desire for self-preservation, will come to taking up one's cross, and that relates to this whole matter a little more. But I'm willing to lose my life for Christ's sake and for the gospel's, because that will involve saving my life, realizing my life, fulfilling my life, rescuing my life, as though against losing it. So what he is doing is distinguishing from between a legitimate self-concern, which is involved here. You don't have selflessness in the sense that the person says, I no longer care about myself. If you no longer care about yourself, it doesn't make any difference whether you save yourself or lose yourself. No, it's not a matter of self-concern. It's a matter of a legitimate self-concern, which realizes that self-concern is realized, is fulfilled by giving oneself, not gratifying one's own desires. We're made to give ourselves. And when we give ourselves, we find ourselves. As over against this selfishness or self-centeredness, which is a wrong kind of self-concern. So it's important to distinguish then between two kinds of self-concern. The wrong kind of self-concern that you have here and the right kind of self-concern which is expressed here in this matter of doing that which will save your life. Now when Jesus did what he did it with a view to realizing himself, realizing his messianic mission, and realizing his approval before the Father. In fact, he did in order to be resurrected. He would never have been resurrected had he not taken the course of action he took. Say nothing of what followed the resurrection in terms of the ascension, sitting at the right hand of God the Father, ascension, and his ultimate glorification in the eschaton, when he becomes King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Say. So Christ was concerned about himself, and had the Father said to Christ, look, I want you to do it. You go to the cross, and that will be the end of you. Christ would have had every right to say, no, thank you. Christ was concerned about himself, but in the proper sense, in that way which fulfilled the will of God and resulted in our redemption. Are you following me now in terms of what this means? All right, let's look at that expression now, take up your cross, because that expression is, again, very often misunderstood. We need to look at that expression in terms of certain emphases, and I would make the following emphases. First of all, the expression is a figurative expression. It is not essentially a literal expression. The context, along with the inflection, tells us that this is, as we discovered, a universal statement addressed to all those who heard him. And obviously, all those who heard him would not literally take up their crosses as he would do. And indeed, the inflection involving the aorist imperative has to do with doing it now. And obviously, not every one of these was going to be crucified physically right then and there. And by the way, Luke adds another element, scriptural testimony, to this because he says, take up your cross daily. Of course, can't mean a physical cross. That's a one for all kind of thing. So it's a figurative cross that he is talking about here with regard to the disciple. Although it might lead to a literal cross in some cases. and where it does, so be it. But the basic meaning is figurative. And it's figurative, again, in relation to what we found in 1436, and that is that one will do God's will regardless of the consequences. That's essentially the meaning of picking up one's cross. Now, what this means also then is that as over against a self-negation or a self-nihilism, what you have is a self-giving. A giving of oneself to God. A self-surrender, a self-commitment. The self continues to exist. It's simply given to God. And given to God, if you take the Lucan emphasis, continually. And I think the aorist imperative in Mark involves the aggressive aorist, which is to say, you begin a process which is then done continually. So continually, this self needs to be given to God. Or in other words, continually, one needs to lose oneself for one's life, for Christ's sake and the gospel's sake. Now, by the way, you see how that runs contrary to these things, because beyond now what we said about saving life here, let's go to these other things. The gaining the world, it has to do with the desire for material things. Now, and being ashamed of me has to do with the desire that we mentioned here of approval, of social approval. Now, these are legitimate desires in their own right, as we've indicated here, material things as part of this process of comfort. I mean, all of us have material things, don't we? This matter of approval is part of the process of fulfilling the true nature of personality. But when these things run counter to God's will, then one needs to surrender these things to God. Say, look, I would rather lose myself, take up my cross, do your will, than gain the world. If and when the getting of material things conflicts with the will of God, then one gives oneself to God. He says, I prefer to give myself and these desires to you and to do your will than to get these things. And that would include both material things and social approval. So it's a matter of self-giving that's involved here. Third is a matter of suffering. The image certainly involves suffering and hardship. This path can never be easy. To begin with, you have the struggle within yourself. And when you give yourself and what you ought to give, and when you deny these desires as you ought, and many of us don't, by the way, even though we claim to be disciples, you're working a real hardship on the self. And of course, when that is taken within a persecution context historically, which was true of what Jesus was saying, what was going to happen to his disciples, as chapter 13 indicates, what happened to the early church, what was happening to the church when the gospel by Mark was written, then you know that element of suffering and hardship is there. But beyond that, it is a matter of decision and volition. Is taking up of one's cross. Someone made this statement, which I think is very much the point. The word cross is a difficult word to face. It has certainly been one of the most misused words in the whole vocabulary of Christianity. We have given the name of cross to so many things that are not a cross at all, in the truly Christian sense of the word. Men speak of calamity as a cross that they must bear. But a calamity is not a cross. It may be a tragedy. Men speak of sorrow or loss as a cross. People speak of their own shortcomings or of temperament and their impatience as a cross they must carry. They often grow quite pious about it. The cross for Jesus was his deliberate choice. Of ministering to men's need of the truth about God, to their need for love, cost what it might. Taking up a cross for the disciple means the deliberate choice of something that could be evaded. To take up a burden which we are under no compulsion to take except the compulsion of God's love in Christ. So we're talking about a moral kind of decision, not something which is thrown upon us over which we have no control, such as illness, for example. But rather a moral decision, and the moral decision is basically this, here I think is the key, to do God's redemptive work as Christ did in this world, and to accept the consequences. And that's why the emphasis on this matter of being ashamed of me. That's the opposite of being ashamed of me. Now, when you say, I want people's approval, I want to avoid the hardship, the suffering, the scorn, of persecution, and therefore I will not witness to Christ, what's the choice that's being made? It's the choice between yourself, self-interest, selfishness, self-centeredness, your own desires, your own comfort, your own ease, etc. It's a choice between that and being redemptive. Because witnessing to Christ is a redemptive act. That means I'm concerned about the other person. I want to see that person in right relationship with God. Expressing God's love in every sense, including witnessing to Christ, but I would say in every sense, because as we have traced the why of Jesus' cross, we have found that it involves the total person of it. Because he healed a man with a withered hand. It's because he healed a leper and touched the leper. Because he did a lot of things involving physical healing, mental healing, demonic, demoniacs, as well as spiritual healing, proclaiming the kingdom of God, his messiahship, forgiveness, etc. So this has to do with the total work of redemption. That's why Christ died. It wasn't merely a cross, as we saw, an individual act, an isolated act, but rather the end of a whole process of doing the will of God. And this is the will of God, redemption. And that will is not merely God's will for Christ, it's God's will for every follower of Christ. Now then, let me spell out here, if I may, let me do something else now very quickly, and that is to move to 9:30 following and pick up a few of the elements anyway that are involved there. We can't get into all that's involved because there's our time limitations. And see how they fit into this picture. And I think you'll see that they fit in this picture along the lines of what we've been discussing here. Because we have really two major laws operative in 9:30, 10:52. One is the law of recurrence of interrogation. We have a problem followed by a solution. The problem, for example, in the instance of the disciples initially, had to do with their discussion regarding greatness. And Jesus deals with that problem. And the problem has to do with someone else's casting out demons. And Jesus' disciples forbidding them. And Jesus deals with that problem, etc. You have a series of problems to which solutions are given. Answers are given. But you also have rare recurrence of contrast which fits into this picture. Now, let me just expand this picture in terms of 930 to 1052. I'll need to do it very, very quickly here because of our time. On the one hand, in terms of the positive, what they ought to do, and this, of course, moves the solution, what you ought to do, says Jesus, is instead of arguing about who is greatest, which is a negative element, concern for greatness, which is this concern for saving your life, gaining the world, etc., which is the concern for approval. I'm sorry for that echo there. Approval, prestige, power. See how this involves self-centeredness? He says, what you need to do is to be a slave of all. Give yourself in service to others, which is Christ-likeness, isn't it? That's the story of Christ's life, giving himself in service to others. And by the way, the image of the child comes into play here. He told in 936, he took a child, put him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Now, what's involved in receiving a child? Well, let's combine this with the other episode involving the rebuking of those who are bringing children to him. See, the rebuking of those who were bringing children to him had to do with the fact that these children would not contribute to the greatness of the disciples. They didn't care about these kids. That's, you know, why worry about these kids? They were concerned about approval, prestige, power, greatness, authority, and children had no part to play in that scheme of things. Well, if you are a slave of all, and note the universality of that, not merely of some, because that too can be self-serving, you see. And we can serve some because we think maybe they will end up serving us. But that's not true of all. So the moment you are a slave of all, including children, then it means that you are concerned about service as such, including being slaves of these children, being redemptive toward them. And this is a childlike kind of thing. It goes on to indicate there in chapter 10, in the episode there, beginning at 10:13. What you see, what you have there is the situation where they're bringing children, and Jesus said when they rebuke the bringing of children, what you need to be is like these children instead of rebuking them. Now, what's a child like? Not childish, by the way, but what's a child like? Well, a child is not like this kind of person. That's why a child would sit around with his parents and around a table and tell stories that embarrass his parents. You know, parents' faces turn red. Why? Because parents are concerned about approval, prestige, reputation. A child doesn't care about that kind of stuff. So he's very blunt and tells all kinds of embarrassing stories in the presence of other people. All right, note the emphasis in relation to... Is this still working?
No. Move the mic up. It kind of slipped down.
Oh, I see. Okay. Whether that will do it or not. Let's look at that episode with regard to forbidding this other man whom they discovered from casting out demons because he was not following us. You see, what they wanted was a monopoly on exorcism. Why? Because that would mean more prestige for them, you see. That would make them very exclusive. It's our little group that exorcises demons. And these other people don't do this. We're special people. So stop this other fellow from doing this. Well, Jesus said, don't forbid him. Why? Because he's for us. He's doing our work. This is what we're all about. We're concerned about exercising demons, period. We're not asking who's doing it and do they belong to our group. Rather, you ought to be concerned about serving people. Or take this episode involving, what I call spiritual surgery there in 942 following. On the one hand, it has to do with that attitude which causes little ones to stumble. In other words, do those things in life which are a stumbling block to others. And the little ones there may not mean the little ones chronologically, but perhaps little ones spiritually. Why? Because one is concerned simply about oneself. Well, he says, what you ought to do is engage in spiritual surgery. That is, even though it is painful, it involves suffering, remove from your life whatever causes stumbling for others. Why? Because your main concern is others, not to cause others to stumble. Have that very interesting story about the Pharisees thrown in here, and that seems to be out of place, but I don't think it is, because I think the Pharisees' problem was essentially the same problem which the disciples were having, and what Jesus was trying to address in this whole statement. The Pharisees came up in order to test him and asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? Now, what was behind this kind of thing? Well, what you had on the part of these Pharisees was lust. They wanted to be free in their sexual practices. And they wanted to be able to discard a wife anytime they felt like it, if they found someone else who was more attractive. And they did this all under the guise of obeying the law. This is quite legal. By the way, people do that today, too. They think that if they get a legal divorce, it's all right. It's morally right. No. Obviously. No, Jesus says, you ought not to be concerned about obeying the law, because as a matter of fact, the law is an accommodation, the law in divorce is an accommodation to the hardness of your hearts, because God knew that there would be this lust, and men and women would leave each other, and in order to avoid some kind of chaos and anarchy, he divided the law. So to obey the law is simply to say, I'm doing that which God devised because of the hardness of my heart. That's not saying anything very great, is it? No. What you ought to do is to be concerned about God's will. And that will is expressed in the ideal of creation with regard to a man and a woman. There again, you see, it goes back to this concept of doing God's will, even though we need to say no to our desires, in this case, no to our passions. Strong desires, lust. And then you have the very interesting case of the rich man. And of course, there, obviously, the concern was for materialism, with all that that means. And materialism involves the kinds of things we were talking about up here. Because, of course, things mean power. Prestige, etc. Jesus says, be willing to say no to that kind of desire. And to surrender these things and follow me. Discipleship. Self-denial, in the sense in which we have indicated it. And of course, a rich young man couldn't take that kind of thing. So he said, I'm sorry, and went about his own way of retaining his riches. And then you come to the very interesting request of the two brothers, which we looked at briefly previously. And the key to that request is in verse 36. What do you want me, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. And he said to them, what do you want me to do for you? In other words, we are concerned that you do for us whatever we ask. Now that's self-centeredness. That's saving life. I want my life for myself, and I want the greatest honor and prestige that I can get. Well, Jesus said over against this point of view, which he said is the point of view in 42 following, of those who rule it over the Gentiles. You want to be like them. But he says in 43, it shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be, and he comes back to this motif again, you have your recurrence of certain motifs, this is one of them, must be slave of all. Why? Because this is Christ-like. Because this is what the Son of Man came into. Not to be ministered unto. You see, this is the mentality here. You minister unto me. And by the way, a lot of so-called ministers have as their main goal being ministered unto by other people. And I'm sorry to say, but I think that's a valid observation as to what happens in so-called ministry. Not ministry at all, in the proper sense. Not to be ministered unto, but to minister. The word for minister is a synonym for serve. Because that's what the Son of Man came to do, and that is true greatness. Now, you see, there's a contrast here between true greatness and false greatness. This is true greatness. Why? Because this is what gains God's approval. These are God pleasers. Whereas this is false greatness. Because this is concerned with being men pleasers. Gaining men's approval. This is to be truly first. Because it's first in God's eyes. This ends up being last, because it's last in God's eyes, although it's first in men's eyes. See those that expression he uses twice in the passage? Those who are first shall be last, and last shall be first. It's on the standpoint of these two different perspectives. Now let's look very quickly at that Bartimaeus incident, which I think would be the climax of the whole passage. They came to Jericho, and as he was leaving Jericho with his disciples, a great multitude, Bartimaeus, a blind beggar, one of these outcasts of society, now, like children, you know, don't come much, you don't worry about these people, if you're worrying about prestige and power and authority. The son of Timaeus was sitting by the roadside, and when he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to cry out and say, Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And many rebuked him, telling him to be silent. But he cried out all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped and said, call him. And they called the blind man, saying to him, take heart, rise, he is calling you. And throwing off his mantle, he sprang and came to Jesus. And Jesus said to him, what do you want me to do for you? You see how different that was from the question, from the statement of the disciples. We want you to do whatever we ask you to do for us. No, Jesus asks, what do you want me to do for you? Now, that's the question of the servant. That's the question of the person who is denying himself, not gratifying his own desires, is concerned about others and God's redemptive work, taking up his cross with Christ and following him. So really what I'm saying is that 9:30 to 10:52 is a commentary on this statement. And 8:34 and 9:1 are saying. You have the same kind of dualism, same kind of contrast. And how beautifully Jesus spells it out in these passages. Well, I hope this gives you some insight into this material. I think we better move tomorrow then to begin discussing this kind of evaluation.